Welcome back to DL Uncut. Now, our next guest is an author and expert in economic and social policy. Her new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, is out now. Please welcome Heather McGee.
How are you, Ms. McGee? How are you?
I'm so good. You know why I'm so good? I spent this morning reading your book, laughing out loud.
Yeah. Well, let me be arrogant. Which one?
Oh, stop it.
I have so many.
Sounds just like him.
Okay, excuse me for the first time author, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he'll brag some more.
Surrender White People. It's my new favorite book on race.
Thank you very much. And actually, when we were researching the book, we came about across a lot of things you believe. Now, when you say that racism, you contend that racism hurts us all, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how does it hurt rich white people? Like, how are they hurt by it? Besides hearing our mouths.
Yeah. When I say everyone, I'm pretty clear that racism is a tool of rich, white, usually male elites to divide and conquer among working class people. If everyone is a nice way to put everyone who's not currently, anyone who's not hurting right now is not hurt by racism.
Right. I just wanted to get that clear. People who heat is on in Texas, they're fine.
Right.
I make that argument because it's interesting to me. Almost every man-made disaster, i.e. what happened in Michigan or now what's going on in Texas, every man-made one is because a greedy white dude knew that what happened or the potential fallout for what was happening wouldn't affect him. And so he was willing to make all of this money. And when it went bad, he would, like right now, what's going on in Texas, there's somebody getting uber rich from that. And so there really is no incentive for people to share, particularly powerful people who decide policy, who decide legislation. What is their incentive for even broaching the subject?
Yeah, well, there isn't. And that's why, you know, power concedes nothing without a fight. You know, this is very clearly a question of power in my mind and my analysis, racism is. You know, I tried to solve, you know, to work on issues of economic inequality, the fact that, you know, people don't have health insurance, that they have too much student debt, that their jobs pay poverty wages. And I tried to do it straight, right? I tried to just talk about the economy, to do the research, get the facts, show it to the decision makers and say, look, you could have, you know, trillions of dollars of more economic activity if you raise the minimum wage, yada, yada, yada. Right. But white resentment of people of color was blocking these kinds of solutions,
even though they would help the majority
of white people. So that's why I wrote this book. Yes.
It's interesting because if you look at trickle-down economics, the premise of that is that I will make all this money and some of it will fall out of my pockets and whatever it does, you'll... Like, nothing is built from the ground, from the top down. Nothing. Nothing is built from the middle down. If you want to build a stable foundation, it has to be from the bottom up. But this Reaganomics notion that we have adopted and that we know is 40, almost 50 years of failure, and we accept it as a viable pathway to people moving forward is laughable. And I think that every time people hear racism, it tells them that they're going to have to feel guilty about what they've done to become this wealthy and the things they've had to do to people to become this wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? To me, it feels like we hit on the formula for creating a solid middle class in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when we really were building the economy from the bottom up. You know, white ethnic immigrants could walk into a factory and walk out set for life. You know, they could go to college for free. They could have subsidized housing. And all of that was racially excluded to black folks.
Sure.
And what my book talks about is what happened when the civil rights movement said, okay, us too, let's be part of the deal. And basically the white majority then turned their backs on that formula that had created their own prosperity. And now 50 years into what they turned to, which was supporting trickle-down economics, supporting Ronald Reagan, shifting from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, and a really conservative, you know, corporate version of the Republican Party at that, we are seeing the spoils. You know, at the heart of my book is the story of the drained public pool, which every black person knows, you know, when they have public pools and then integration, you know, they responded by draining the public pool. So that means white people lost on a pool. Black mm-hmm. folks still don't know
sure.
how to swim.
Sure.
And we're just sitting at the bottom of this pool now.
Right.
It's a shame.
And, you know, we can't fight climate change because white people are resistant to it because they're not sure what it's going to cost them. You know, our schools are underfunded. We got $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. You know, our bridges are collapsing. You know, Texas is a perfect example of drained pool politics. It's time to go a different route. And I believe that this book, The Sum of Us, you know, it took me across the country for 3 years trying to write this book. I'm actually more hopeful at the end of it because I thought it was going to be really complicated to solve our big public problems, our economic problems. But all we have to do is just be a little bit less racist.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Just don't hate niggas so much.
But you know what's so interesting is that their hate is so strong that they are willing to even sacrifice their own family. Like, they don't care. When you talk about, you know, the drained pool, they knew they would suffer and they didn't care. You know, I was hopeful and then I saw what happened January 6th and I thought, wow, they killed their own. They knew they were going in there after their own. So despite how it was going to affect them, they still marched on. And I think that's still the situation that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't know your history, you know, we're doomed to repeat it. I finished the book before January 6th, but I include a long story about Colfax, Louisiana,
nice.
Which was 100 years ago. And it was the exact same thing. There was a Democratic election that brought in a multiracial, you know, voting bloc. This white mob attacked the courthouse. Black people came in hundreds to defend it. They slaughtered 100 black folks and burned down the courthouse. They burned down the edifice of their own government rather than submit to a multiracial democracy. What does that sound like?
It's quintessentially American. It really is. Yeah. Like when people say those who don't learn from history are destined to repeat, it's not true. Those who don't learn from history are destined to have somebody quote it to them. That's that we make our own history up. We really do. Racism is so ingrained in America. It's almost like when I was a friend, he got shot. I was growing up, I had a friend, he got shot. And the doctors told him, look, if we try to take this out, it could kill you. It's such a, you can live with it. Let's hope it doesn't move around. But if it doesn't, you'll live a normal life. If we go in and try, that's racism in America. It's so ingrained in us, such a part of us, that to remove it could potentially kill the host. Look at how many holidays you can't have. Look at how many schools or bridges or statues you can't walk by. It is so ingrained in America that you can't take a little piece of it out. You have to deconstruct the whole thing. And I think for them, that's a bridge too far.
But here's the thing. We are so young, right? This country is so young and so powerful, and we are soon going to be in a place where there is no racial majority by numbers.
Sure. Like
power and money is a different thing. Why not make a new world here in what was supposed to be a new world? Why not snatch out of the ideals and the promise of this nation something that was worth our people's sacrifice? You know, a lot of folks are like, I'm giving up on America. I'm going. I'm like, no, my people have sacrificed too much.
Well, I ain't going nowhere. I'm not leaving. No, I'm not. And I agree with you. And I think really more than anything else, after a while, reason doesn't work. Compassion doesn't work. Empathy doesn't work. What works, I think what scared people more than anything else was you had an incumbent president who was a demagogue who was willing to use the levers of government in a duplicitous way, and everybody knew it was happening. Like, you can't tell me you thought the election was stolen. What he intimated was that somehow black people managed, because usually when something is nigger rigged, it don't work. But but for this conceit. But what happened was black people voted at about the same rate. It was white people that turned against, a larger majority of white people that turned against him. And rather than deal with that fact, he would rather say, I'm going to blame it on them, because we're the one group of people that you never have to have any proof to blame something on. You don't have to just
criminal. Yep, that's right.
Just like even in Texas, they blamed it on the windmills. Windmills are the minorities of energy. Like they're the niggas of energy. They really like these windmills. These windmills, they look at it, cause cancer, and they just tear shit up, and they don't work. They fall asleep. But we're it is so in the stories that they have told about us that we now believe are so ingrained in just all elements of our lives. Like our oppressors are on the money that we work for, and it's so ingrained in us. I think it has to be a total restructure, and I don't know that this country can really remain or even have any semblance of itself if that happens.
Well, you know, again, a country that was born and created out of a belief in a hierarchy of human value, that some groups of people are better than others, a country that was born on stolen people, stolen land, and stolen labor, does need to be transformed, does need to be remade. But I believe that ultimately, what is a country if not for its people? And that's a thing they always like to forget on the right, right?
Right.
We love our country, but we'll let our people starve.
Right.
Right. And as, you know, I look at young people today, you know, the youngest generation already has no racial majority, and they are pushing. They are pushing. They are anti-racist. They are blowing up gender. They are saying, save the planet now. They are saying, let us share all equally. That's who America's becoming, whether they like it or not. The desperate nature of this last gasp of white supremacy and patriarchy and greed, it's clear that they know that the writing is on the wall. I have a lot of faith in the youngest generation. I have a lot of faith in them to fulfill America's promise. You saw Amanda Gorman up there, the National Youth Poet Laureate at the right. inauguration, spitting fire and wisdom. I mean, that's what we're becoming. Everybody
but,
else
but you know what, and I just want to push back a bit. The 60s had a bunch of young people who were motivated. For its time, there were a lot of young people who were motivated, who wanted things to change. We had a lot of pivotal changes that was associated with the 60s. And what happened was they got older and they got tired.
They got comfortable. Yeah.
And I think the reason this seems more resonant is because we are more engaged. I think there have been examples of the young taking us but so far, and then a lot of times taking it back too. A lot of times taking it back. And I think that what makes this, and to your point, this so urgent is that now people that were more apathetic are engaged, and people that were more disconnected are now engaged. And I think there is a stick-to-itiveness that elementally has never existed here.
Yes, it has become a personality trait to be an active citizen.
Sure.
It has become an activity. It's become a social thing to do. It's become part of folks' identity. And, you know, I mean, I wrote this book as a Black woman, as an invitation to a multiracial America. I wrote it for Black people who have to work with white people. I wrote it for Black people who are, you know, showing up at their city council and having to deal with this desire to avoid the truth of the issue. You know, for me, obviously, I am by no means saying that racism doesn't always hit its target, right? Racism always hits its target. It always hits Black folks first and worst. But it is an illusion and it is a lie to say that there is not a distorting factor of something as total as racism in America. You know, it distorts the way we make decisions in this society. You know, LBJ, the last white man to be the last Democrat to be elected by, majority of white people, he said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's above the highest colored man, he won't notice if you're picking his pocket. If you make him feel better than him, he'll empty out his whole pocket for you. And that's really been the story of the last 50 years.
But how do we change? I mean, I understand, you know, and I agree with DL, you know, there were a lot of young people who were involved in the 60s. I think the difference now is, you know, with the advent of social media and the ability to galvanize so many people at the same time. But my question is, how do we get back to a place where we can at least agree upon what is truth? In the post world of alternative facts, how do we at least get there? Now you have even news anchors, when at one point it was, you know, taboo to even, you know, interject your personal opinions into something and to say something that was other than factual. And now I believe that we've gotten to a place where that just ebbs and flows, and it shouldn't. Truth should always be truth. How do we get back there?
That is the thing that scares me the most. I think of it as the information apocalypse, you know, the fact that we have disinformation psyops campaigns running on us 24/7. The fact that a billionaire started a right-wing network and has been, you know, completely unaccountable to the truth. That's why I'm proud of the work that Color of Change does. I serve on the board of it. And they go straight to the corporate actors, right? They say, we're going to attack the advertisers. We're going to attack the investors and the stakeholders. We're going to hold Facebook accountable, Twitter, YouTube. You really have to go upstream to these corporations that are selling hate for profit, because it is more profitable for them to cultivate this outrage machine than it is for them to tell the straight truth. But in a democracy, we do have control. We have not updated and done media reform in three generations, but it's on the table now. We have got to hold these big corporate giants accountable for what they're doing to our democracy.
You know what's so funny? There's not a bigger patriot in the United States of America, and I don't believe this ever existed, than black women. I think it's the most amazing story. I think decades from now, when publishers, when rich white dudes don't control the narrative, their story is going to be resonant and one that people follow, in civilizations to come. It isn't what they think of us. It isn't the mechanism they have used against us. It is our belief in them. Our inherent belief that somehow we're inferior. I remember arguing with people, and they were telling me about black on black crime. Well, ain't no white man ever lived around you. We get a special dispensation as if we're inherently evil. There's no such notion as black on black crime. Crime is about proximity. If something happened to you, they would look most immediately at the people who are in your immediate vicinity. But this notion that we have bought into, that somehow we are less than, that somehow they're right, that somehow the white man's ice is colder. If this book does nothing to affect them, and everything, the book that you've written, and which I think you've done a brilliant job, if it does nothing to affect them and everything to reset our metric, I think it will be an invaluable tool. I just think that we have our stories here start in the middle, and so we're writing the end. So all we have is what we were in servitude, never anything before. And so when that is your reference point, everything you think about is going to be jaundiced, is going to be skewed. And I think more than anything else, we have to know that we were something before, and obviously we'll be something after. But I think books like this that are well-researched, I bet you people read your book and can't believe it happened, or can't believe it's true, or can't believe it, because they're inherently, our frequency is just not set for that.
No, well, thank you for saying all those things. I think it's right. I mean, we have to know our own history, know our own truth, and also not fall for the okey-doke. You know, I mean, white people need to wake up and stop falling for the okey-doke of folks like Ted Cruz packing his bag, heading to Cancun.
And not even trying to hide with it, just out in the open.
I'm telling you.
Daughter.
I'm telling you, too much white is bad for you. Like, I don't care if it's rice, I don't care if it's potatoes, even cocaine got to get cut. Too much white is bad for you. I'm telling you. What do you hope in the end? Obviously, you want it to be a literary success. Obviously, you want it to be a financial success. Those things are obvious, so you wouldn't have written the book. You had some things that were inherent on your heart, and I think that was the ethos of how this book was written. What do you hope happens?
I hope that white people who read the book stop voting against their own interests, ask when they hear, you know, right-wing people in their lives or right-wing people in the corporate media, you know, why are they selling me this story? What are they trying to gain from selling me this story that says for me to hate and distrust and disdain my black and brown neighbors? And I also hope that it makes it a little bit easier for us to move, all of us, black, brown, and white, into the multiracial future that we're becoming. Because if we're always having our own stories, right, if it's racism is something that is bad for black people and good for white people, and I don't see how we ever come together, right? I don't see how we ever overcome if we don't realize that racism is a poison and the first people who drink it are the people who concocted it, right? We've got to realize that this is an old belief. It was created, this hierarchy of human value, in order to justify an economic system that is no longer serving us. And so let's just get rid of it. Let's open up the hatch and kick it out into space.
You're the most dangerous. I'm telling you, I think that I'm not hardened by a lot of things. I'm very cynical. And I think even hearing you, I want to believe, I don't have that mechanism. But you are so hopeful that is sickening. It makes me nauseous is what it does. But and your area diet, you're bright, you're reasoned, you're intelligent, you're well thought out, you're beautiful, you're smart. What makes you feel this fucking hopeful? Because I don't get it. I don't get it.
You know, hope has always been in the black politic, right? I mean, I can't stand here as I am right now as the descendant of enslaved people, you know, sitting here talking to you wonderful black people with the audience that you all have and that we have and not have hope. It's not possible. I grew up with my great-grandparents, both of whom lived to be over 100. I have a grandmother now who's my son's great-grandmother who is 94 today. Slavery was just behind in her shadow, right? And I grew up with that. And here we are today. So I think, you know, politics has always been, hope has always been a part of black politics. And I think it's really important for us to keep that touchstone because our ancestors had to deal with far more with far less. And so I can't not be hopeful, right? I mean, there's too much been sacrificed to get us here for me to not think we can finish the rally.
We've talked a lot about the problems. From a policy perspective,
yes.
What are concrete policy measures that yes. would give you an indicator if things are moving in the right direction?
Great. I'm so excited. I love the policy is my love language.
Finally, this thing asked me something I want to hear. It's crazy.
So first of all, we absolutely do need reparations. And some people might say, okay, well, if she's saying that racism has a cost for everyone, then maybe black people shouldn't get any special money or dispensation. That's obviously exactly wrong. I'm saying that one of the barriers to us getting reparations is this zero-sum idea, is white people who think that if black people get a check, it's somehow going to come out of their pocket. And that's not the case. The government is the one that enslaved us, that segregated us, that stripped our wealth over generations and denied us the ability to have it. The government, which we all fund, is going to be the one to pay. And Citigroup, no less, did a report this summer that said that if we had closed the racial economic divide 20 years ago, our economy would be $16 trillion larger. So reparations for me is seed capital for the America that we're becoming. It's seed capital for us all to flourish and thrive. It is an economic stimulus to cut those checks. So we absolutely need that. We need to cancel student loan debt. This is something that is
so the current administration has bantered 10,000 about, and I guess progressives on the other end want 50,000. So mm-hmm. is it any number or is it a specific number you think achieved this goal?
So listen, $10,000 in student loan debt cancellation is great. It's a lot better than just sitting there and let it collect interest and, right. and keep pushing back home ownership and retirement for the entire generation, particularly of black people who, you know, because of the racial wealth divide have to borrow more and at higher numbers. So $10,000 is good. Now, I've done the math. I think we need to do more. Yeah. I think $50,000 is actually the right number. These white folks, you know, were sitting up in Congress at Demos, the organization I used to run. We did a report where we calculated every single member of Congress that went to a public school, and most of them did, a public college, a state school, what they used to pay and how much because of the government cutbacks, because of the drained pool that students today had to pay. And, you know, it's a generational piece. The median age in Congress is somebody who went to college for free. So Joe Biden, bless his heart, President Biden, I don't think he gets at a gut level that this entire experiment of the debt for diploma system is racist. It's another form of financial slavery. It has nothing to do with good economics or good investments or good policy. And we've just got to get rid of it.
Well, the book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. If it doesn't work out, it's going to be just some of us. Thank you, Heather McGee. I appreciate
and
it. You're delighted.
Hopeful.
Thank you.
I'm with
Thank you.
You
very much. Good luck to you.
Our next guest is a celebrity chef, author, restaurateur, and chef and chief culinary advisor for Sodexo Magic. His book, A Message to My Children, is available where books are sold. Please welcome to the show, G. Garvin.
What's up, young man?
Hey, how you doing, man? You looking good, but how y'all calling me celebrity chef? You know I hate that.
Yeah. Well, no, you don't. Well, you don't actually hate that. That's stop it.
And I'm sure you love the check that comes along with it.
Stop it. You can pretend like you hate it.
Exactly.
You look so distinguished, but it looked like you don't serve pork. Doesn't
no,
it
he
look
doesn't.
Like he doesn't?
Or, you know,
no, my brother, we did not have that.
No kind of potatoes, none of that.
No,
like,
my
you
know, brother.
I don't do that.
No
what
swan.
Kind of chicken was that? Get your out of here.
Right. You, it's funny because you're my favorite chef, but because you've made, I think, food accessible. Like the eating isn't mysterious and home cooking is mysterious, but like restaurateurs and ordering at restaurants and the things that go together is kind of intimidating for the average person.
Yeah, DL, man, you're one of my early friends, customers. And man, you know, when I was in the kitchen, it wasn't very cool. I just did what I do best. And because of people like you and your family, I was able to, you know, continue growing and developing and turning my life into something great. And for me, it's always been the same thing, transparency in food, right? I want to know that, you know, what I'm eating is good, quality product. You know, I want to know where it's from. And that's kind of what I've done.
What makes food good? Because I mean, I know, I think poor people make the best food, but it's always salted and greasy. So they season the shit out of it, and you don't ever really know what the taste is, right?
Well, that's like, because butter makes everything better.
Yeah, but that's poor people, like, we salt the shit out of shitty food, and it's excellent.
You know what's funny? You know, after Sunday church, all the black women have the salt and the hot.
Right.
Hot sauce in their pot.
Right.
So in their mind, it's like, fuck it, just make a big batch and then season it up. You know, my philosophy, man, is everything has its own identity. And as you build your layers, you know, guys, I'm doing an interview. As you do your layers, everything has to taste good. So, and for me, man, it's all about the attention to detail. I tell you something, man.
Right.
You, and this is no BS, you, I think, are the funniest man alive. And it's because of the attention to detail in your jokes. When you say, your mama said, you know, run my light bill up.
Right.
That's real.
Right.
But it's the way you express it.
Right.
Anybody can say, you know, parents think their light bill is going to be too high for any reason. But the way you say it, man, is the attention to detail. And for me, man, this is all I know. I had to do it right.
I remember when he used to serve my Christmas party till it got way too expensive.
No, I remember. Food was delicious. And then I
was like, this is the last time I'll be having this bouillabaisse. And then he had his own show on TV and he never talked to me again. No, and he used to, I didn't know what this was, but he would like wipe everything off and put garnish, like every meal he touched. Like that was what I would learn was plating the meal, making sure, like wiping everything off. And that's to me the kind of attention to detail you kind of alluded to, right?
Yeah, man. You know, so I just opened my steakhouse here in Atlanta, DL. We're literally 10 days in, and it is why we've started out so great, man. Is because I want to touch every single dish. I want to make sure the sauce that is reduced down is, you know, the right consistency on every single thing we do. And it's the same with my, you know, my role with Magic Johnson as chief culinary advisor. You know, we're responsible, man, for about $700 million in business. And he makes sure we're accountable, you know, for what we're doing with the food. So it, for me, it's all about the detail. Because, you know, man, I can't go back to the hood.
Right.
This is all I got.
You can't. You're the one. It's the first time I ever, because I used to always watch him cook knowing that I was never going to do it. I was like, oh, this is very interesting, but I got a woman. What do I need to cook for?
Wow.
What are we saying?
I got somebody in the sheet.
What? But the first time
I'm gonna let him get away with
it. No, it's true.
I'm gonna let it slide.
How come you don't cook? How come you don't tell jokes? It's the same thing.
That's not so disrespectful.
But You told me about a steak, and you said it only needs salt, a really good cut of meat, salt, pepper, and that's it. Like, it didn't need, like, to be holes poked in and garlic. It just needed salt. Like, I was like, because I'm used to my mother poking holes in it and putting garlic. It was crazy. And when I did it, it was just, it was more flavorful than I'd ever experienced. Because I thought I didn't like steak till then.
You know what's funny, DL? My mom would do the same thing. She'd buy these cheap cuts of meat.
Right.
And then they call it tenderizing the meat. So right. They heat it with a fork.
Right.
And then they put something red on it that was actually called meat tenderizer.
Right.
I'm like, Mom, that's all in your head. You know, so for me, man, all of our meat is wet aged. It is grass fed. And we spend very little things to it. We do very little to it. The integrity of the meat is kosher salt and a really good oil, and we marinate the meat in olive oil and garlic, and we keep it out at room temperature, right before it goes on the grill. It's nice and tender, and that's all we do, man. That's all we do.
But don't you think that comes with, I guess, re-educating people? Because I think for most of us, you know, you go to a restaurant, and as soon as the food comes out, you reach for salt, you reach for all of these sauces to put on it without even tasting it the way the chef wanted you to experience it. So how do you get people to understand that you want them to experience the food the way it was meant to be experienced it in terms of how you prepared it?
Tell them they can't handle damn salt.
They can't handle salt.
You see this nigga? You see this nigga, right? This nigga look like sugar. Of course you can't handle salt. Are you crazy? Motherfucker, no. We don't have that. That's how you do it. How do you tell a nigga no? That's
well, you
how
know,
you do
but
it.
You think about it. People will say quickly, but I paid for it. I want it how I want it, right? But you want them to experience it the way that you prepared it.
Well, let me tell you this. At Low Country Steak in Atlanta, we make our own ketchup. We make our own steak sauce. We make our own mayo. We make all of our aiolis. So at the end of the day, if you want a steakhouse, we'll give you a steakhouse, but we do not send salt to the table. Mm. And I'll be completely truthful with you. There's not one thing on my menu that has salt in it besides the steaks, and that is a Black Himalayan sea salt that we use. Everything else is a different seasoning method. I just don't believe we need it.
You know, it's very funny. It like in every walk, in every endeavor, in every system, racism, particularly racism is in all walks of life. But I remember going to a steakhouse, because that's my favorite thing. Like, the steakhouse is just manly and dope. The ones you can just drink and smoke. So I'm coming to yours Monday is what I'm basically saying, for free. But that's not the point. What we're talking about right now is, so I go to this place, and I'm not going to say he was a dope dude, he was cool, but they would order steaks, and Black people would order them well done, no pink at all. And if they ordered a filet, he wouldn't send it out to them. He'd send a horrible cut of meat. And he said to me, they don't know the difference anyway. So they would pay this money for this really expensive cut of meat, and he said he'd send it out to them anyway, and they wouldn't know because they fried the hell out of it. And the way that we're treated in restaurants, like, if you go in and you want a booth, they call us boofers. Like, it's so many things. What I'm excited about your restaurant is it's one of the places where you get to learn, eat, have a good meal, socialize, and feel like the person who's making the meal, it has a connection to you in some respects.
You know what, DL? Man, I'm telling you, man, I love you, man. You are the realest I know, man. I'm saying that in the most humble way, and I mean it sincerely. You know, your words are true, man. You know, we've been treated like second-class citizens when we go into restaurants and made to, you know, be uncomfortable if you want your steak medium well, right? So those things have happened historically over the years, and they're not factual. You know, you can order your meat medium rare or you can order it medium well. And the way the process is, how it's cooked, should be exactly the same, right? And it's unfortunate, man, but you're right. When you come to my restaurant, it's a fellowship, man. It's a fellowship. It's like you might see somebody, you know, just like the joint in L.A., man.
Yep.
It's a steakhouse. You know, we ain't made men, but we men that's made.
Right. Right.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's so dope. I remember the last restaurant joint on 3rd, and I had never seen a Black dude own a restaurant in Beverly Hills. That was his. I'd never seen it. And so I remember Tracy Morgan coming, and Tracy Morgan would take off his shirt, and every restaurant would just run down. And you would see, but it was just such a warm and welcoming environment that when it left, I felt like we missed something. But I think more than anything else, I eat everywhere. I've eaten, we've seen a lot of things. But one thing that you have that I think is very interesting is the connectivity to the community, the quality of the ingredients, the diversity in the menu. Like, it's hard to take people that I tasted snails. I never would have tasted them. I never liked mushrooms. Like, man, I don't like that shit. I don't like garlic or onions. But I think having a conversation with people, with a person who you know what they're doing and can show you, like, kind of, like, you would tell me where things come from and why it's important. And I think that kind of relationship is communal, because we come from a place that is very communal, and that is based around the kitchen. It's based around food. And to extrapolate that out and have that in an environment where you can dine out and have a great experience is something different. Isn't the restaurant industry in a lot of trouble right now? COVID has decimated it, right?
You know what, DL, to your point, man, you know, as children, you sit down and eat what your mama told you to eat, right? And as we get older, and you know, fortunately, if we get a little money, you know, we want to know where our food is from, right? So the integrity of the product is actually about. And then, you know, second to that, you know, tonight, man, I'm doing a blackened veal chop with cheddar cheese grits and a ponzu butter with crispy onion rings. And the veal is you know, farm raised, right? The grits are, you know, Georgia grits. But I'm telling you a story about how I created this wonderful dish that you're gonna relate to, because trust me. And to your second point, yeah, man, you know, I've been open 10 days and I prayed, I looked at the amount of money we had invested in the building and we went ahead and moved forward. But yeah, man, we need, you know, as much money as we spend on Hennessy and Louis Vuitton, if we spend a third of that in our black-owned restaurants, we'll get back.
Right, right. You have been integral in a lot. Like, you opened a restaurant, Rain. Everybody came through. I remember when you used to host our Christmas parties, and they started to be epic. One of the Smollett boys worked for you, right? Jesse, right? He worked for you, right? No, I'm asking you a question. You don't have to. I'm not trying to. No.
Or is he?
I'm just asking you a question. I could be wrong.
Nah, yeah, you wrong in the motherfucker.
He's like,
No, that wasn't. Okay.
I could swear.
No, that wasn't.
Nope.
No, yeah. Okay. No. Because I was going to ask you, has a sandwich ever come up missing? somebody was beat up.
Right. Well, how about we switch gears? You know what I think is important? I think it's great.
That was the person that the dog had in the backyard.
I think it is super great that we get to see a black chef, and I think we need to see more of them, right? Like I was telling DL, I saw this this article about these guys called Ghetto Gastro, right? They're a couple of young black guys out of the Bronx who did a collaboration with Williams and Sonoma, and basically they were talking about how important it is for young black men to be okay with, you know, being in the cooking industry so that they can teach, you know, the people in their neighborhood about food, the importance of healthy food. How important do you think it is that more black people, whether it's male or female, get into the culinary industry?
Listen, you know, I'm 52 years old and I'm truly the culinary OG, because when I started, there was no black people on TV. There's no black people in the kitchen. And I was one of a few, and it was challenging. I mean, I was just constantly having to, you know, keep people in line, because they got it confused, because, you know, a black man is in the kitchen and not playing football or baseball or basketball or trying to rap or sell dope. This food didn't change my life. It saved my life. And because of what food has done for me, I've been able to save countless lives of young black men and women who would not have decided to go into culinary arts but yet do something else. So the one thing that's important is absolutely. But you know what you got to do? You got to get more people that look like me that are willing to take an opportunity or a chance on putting more people that look like us on TV, right? Because that's the platform.
And you, even the restaurants, period, is when people, it's oftentimes people's first job, is people who can't, if you need flexibility, it's a great job for that. People who have just coming out and kind of being reintroduced to society, it's a great job for that. My daughter, Ryan, you know, she just had her first baby, and I'm a grandfather. She learned her love, she wanted to be a chef because of you. So she graduates from USC. And the day after she graduated, she said, I want to go to culinary school. So fuck you for that. That's one.
You're welcome.
That's one. But the other is that what you said earlier is that it's so interesting that we only see ourselves entertaining or telling jokes or doing it. And there's so many ways to bring people to the table. You're not a celebrity chef. Because you were a celebrity and then you became a chef, you are a celebrity chef because your food was so good, people wanted to hang out with you and you wanted to you got TV shows, you wrote books. And so I think that truly loving something can take you places to your point that you would never have imagined. So where have you, where's the craziest place food has ever taken you?
Poland. Warsaw, Poland. Because
really?
Of my love, I went to Poland. And I worked in a hotel called the Sopot Hotel. I was like Mexican in America. I ain't understand shit. I was fast. And they was like, he'll work. And that's what I did, man. And you're right, yo. And I tell you, man, Ryan is a beast.
Yes, she is.
She took her butt off. She's smart. She's funny. She's a strong leader. And she's all about black excellence. I'm telling you straight up. She is all about black excellence. I actually miss her. I haven't seen her in a while. But, yeah, no, D.L., when I tell you food saved my life, man, it's real. You know, I got partners who, you know, passed on or they locked up because they didn't have anything to do. So this is absolutely, you know, not just something to do now on the side, but, you know, the food industry, man, it's $7 billion industry. You know, Rachel Ray, you know, she's making $800-900 million a year. So there's absolutely equity and liquid cash that you can make doing it.
Let me ask you something. Is that why you wrote a book? Because every celebrity chef writes a cookbook. But you wrote a book that wasn't just about recipes. It wasn't just about stories around food. It was like your life was interweaved into it. So what was your inspiration for wanting to write a book?
I just want to make black men comfortable, man. You know, every time I'm out, I see black men, and they be like, yo, man, my wife the biggest fan. Yo, man, my wife loves you, man. Yo, my wife be seeing you. I'm like, nigga, you too. Or you wouldn't know who I am, right? And feel comfortable with that, right? Feel comfortable telling that story, telling that truth. So I just decided to put pen to pad, man, and my book is called A Message to My Children. And it's just life lessons, man. It's just everything I learned about whether it's too much cologne, right, cell phone in public. Just how to be a good young man, how to be a good person, and make people trust that they can put money behind you, right? Listen, Viola Davis said it. The only thing missing, you know, the only difference between success and us and them is somebody giving us the opportunity. And if you want somebody to give you an opportunity, you got to fit the profile, right? You got to do your part. So this book is for me to help people understand you got to do your part.
Man, that's amazing. You have a lot of funny anecdotes in the book. What's the funniest thing ever happened at your restaurant?
Funniest thing that ever happened at my restaurant was Suge Knight calling my restaurant one night and asking if his wife was up in there. Keyshawn called me and asked me if his wife was up in there. I was like, man, look, y'all got to figure it out. We fooled him.
I know, that's right.
And you fooled him because now you look just like him. It's crazy now.
Hey, look, I do want to tell you this, though. In this book, I write, and I tell you this, I got my sticky. It says, never sit in the front row of a D.L. Hughley show. Look, let me tell you why I wrote that. Because before I ever met you, you performed at the Roxy. Man, you looked like you was maybe 12.
Yeah, that was Roxy, yeah.
It's now the Buckhead Theater. You killed it. I wasn't even supposed to be in there because I think you're probably a little older than me, not by much. But I actually snuck in the back door, right? And I was up in the audience, peeking over the rail. That was sitting up front, or you killed them.
I remember your last restaurant. We got so drunk. We got so drunk that he had to follow me to the hotel, like behind me. I'm so glad you have another restaurant, because I really hope people get to experience the things that we've talked about. But the other thing, you're just a good man doing what he's supposed to do and giving light out with it. So I hope that everybody who gets a chance to sit at your table and just get a little of that light you give, man. You're dope.
Hey, DL, I love you, man. I appreciate you. You know, you've always been a man of integrity, you know, which is why you have such a great family, because you lead by example. And I can tell you honestly, man, and I've never, because of your blessings early on in my career, I was able to achieve things because you trusted me. And I can say you trusted me, and I sit here today, man, because of opportunities like you and your amazing wife has given to me over the years, man. So thank you, and thank you for today.
Thank you, man. So I'm going to eat and drink some shit up at Low Country Steak in Atlanta. So put it on my tab, nigga. G-Guard. G-Guard. Thank you, man. Thank you.